Finally, to a story we've been desperate to tell for over 6 months, but thought it was right to wait until today, the 11th day of the 11th month. So much of the story of war is told by men, because until recently, they're the ones who tended to do all the fighting. But women have always kept families and homes going and nursed for the dead and dying. So it was with real gratitude that we received an email from Making History listener Dick Robinson in Gloucestershire earlier this year, telling us about some incredible family diaries he'd come across. They're written by his great-aunt, Edith Appleton, who in her 30s served from 1914 to 1919 in makeshift hospitals in France, often just behind the front line. The insight she's left us is quite gripping, so we've packed off Making History's Krupa Thakral to meet Dick and find out more.
Edie died in 1958, and after Edie died, my mother had the job of clearing the house. I think what happened was that she put these diaries aside as something of interest. And I can remember 50 years ago, I started to type them out.
What makes these diaries so different to other wartime diaries?
They focus on the day-to-day life of a woman, and that's unusual. They were handwritten, they were addressed to her mother. They're surprisingly frank about the horror that Edie was experiencing on a day-to-day basis.
April the 18th, 1915. We have had over 600 through our hospital today, badly wounded and fearfully collapsed. We went on duty at 5:30 a.m. and stayed on until 9 p.m. Amputation of arms and legs and insides cut and packed in. I'm very tired. September the 11th. We had a convoy of 399 in yesterday, only 70 wounded. Far the most of the sick were suffering badly from shell shock. It is sad to see them. They dither like palsied old men and talk all the time about their mates who are blown to bits or their mates who are wounded and never brought in. The whole scene is burnt into their brains and they can't get rid of the sight of it. One rumpled, raisin-faced old fellow said his job was to take bombs up to the bombers, and sometimes, going through the trenches, he had to push past men with their arms blown off, and they would yell at him, "Don't touch me." But he had to get past, because the fellows must have their bombs.
Was it all doom and gloom, or did Edie ever have any time to switch off and relax?
I think the wonderful quality of the diaries is that this mix of the day-to-day horror with her wonderful adventures, somehow, particularly when she was away from the front line, but not always, she and other nurses would somehow get hold of a car or go off for a walk in the woods. Extraordinary stories, right when they were near Ypres, where the war was really raging, that she and a nurse would go and sit up on a little hill nearby and overlook, see what was happening, write their diaries, collect flowers, have tea. You know, you can imagine a cloth laid out on the grass and them having tea, and there's a war nearby. So although she took her job very, very seriously and it was relentless, there were the lighter sides as well.
You mention Edie going travelling with one of her friends. What do we learn about the emotional attachment and the various relationships that Edie formed?
They must have been very powerful, I think, the friendships, although, of course, they were often being moved. She was moved at one time, and there was obviously some disciplinary thing. I think she'd stood up to a senior nurse who was making her do something entirely unreasonable, and Edie found out several years later that she was actually moved for that reason.
And what about relationships with the patients? She must have been quite emotionally affected by what was going on around her.
She was. There are not very many. One or two descriptions, tragic descriptions, of young men taking weeks to die. And she obviously formed quite close relationships with those young people.
March the 13th, 1915. My poor little boy Kerr died yesterday. He'd been in for 15 days suffering from gas and has been extremely and dangerously ill all the time. But only the day before yesterday he realised he was not going to get well. He told me, "They wouldn't let me go sick. Every time they said it was rheumatism and would wear off, and marching with full pack and dodging shells was dreadful. He kept whispering all sorts of messages for home and his fiancée. Then he would call, "Sister?" And when I bent down to hear, he would say, "I do love you. When I'm gone, will you kiss me?"
Now, the diaries scan several years, and having gone through them, do you feel that Edie changed from the beginning compared to the end?
I don't really. I think that's one of the striking things. There's her underlying this professionalism, and she talks a lot about, you know, day after day of scrubbing wards, and somehow that doesn't change.
Now, many of us keep diaries in the hope that they don't fall into the wrong hands and that they remain private. Mm. How do you feel that your great-aunt Edie would feel about you going through her diaries?
Most of the people in the First World War, men and women, didn't talk about it much when they came home. And this, I'm sure, I know, was true of Edie. I think she would be astonished to think that there was so much interest.
November the 12th, 1918. Peace. Thank God for that. Feels very queer too, kind as if your elastic had snapped. We came back to Treport only a few minutes after the news reached it, and in less than an hour the whole place had gone stark mad. Flags of all nations flying from everywhere, sirens blowing in long shrieks, short shrieks, jerks every way. In the music room we bought 6 bottles of good port, and we all drank to peace. Here endeth the fighting part of the war. God save the King.
The armistice, as described by Edith Appleton in her diaries. And Making History listener Dick Robinson was talking with our very own Krupa Thakra. Edith, I'm pleased to say, now has her own website, and you can see it by going to bbc.co.uk/radio4/Making History. It's well worth a look. Listening to that was an old friend of the programme, Terry Charman, who is senior historian at the Imperial War Museum. Terry, what do you make of these diaries?
Well, I found them absolutely fascinating and indeed moving, especially her description of the death of the, as she puts it, my poor little boy, Kerr. We have, at the Imperial War Museum in our department of documents, a large number of people's private papers and diaries and letters. But those of nurses on the Western Front, and certainly for the time that she was out there, we haven't anything really like that in our collection. And they are really splendid descriptions of life in the hospitals behind the lines, just behind the lines, on the Western Front during the Great War.
And how unusual is it, therefore, for something like this to turn up? I mean, what kind of reaction do you get when you see something like this for the first time?
Well, I take it also, I can't speak for them, but, well, perhaps I can speak for them, my colleagues in the Department of Documents would be absolutely delighted to have something like this in its collection. And I really do think that in this year, the 90th anniversary of the armistice, that something like this, something that was well-written, compassionate, witty, does in fact deserve a much, much wider circulation. I really do think it's one of the most interesting, informative and readable accounts of life on the Western Front, the medical side, that I've ever come across.
Well, from a man of your experience, that's some praise. Terry Charman, thank you very much, and thanks to you for listening. Next week, we try to get to the truth behind the legend of the man we see as a pirate or even traitor, but who the Americans revere as the father of their navy. That's the story of John Paul Jones in Making History next Tuesday afternoon at 3:00.